Now, what are we going to do? Yes, indeed. Dr. Alan Chapman has written a book which is called Caves, Coprolites and Catastrophes. This is the story of pioneering geologist and fossil hunter William Buckland. And I am very interested to hear all about this. And Dr. Chapman joins me on the phone right now. Dr. Alan Chapman, good afternoon and welcome to Talk Radio Europe. How are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. Yes, fortunately staying plague-free, as I hope you all are.
Indeed, at the moment anyway. We haven't been tested recently, but hopefully all is good.
Yes.
I'm delighted to be able to talk to you, but I want to ask you firstly, and this will tell you the level of individual you were dealing with. I've never heard of a coprolite. What is it?
Well, indeed, you know what caves are.
Yes.
You know what catastrophes are. Catastrophes
yes.
were believed to be the great cataclysms that formed the Earth's surface. But the word coprolite is actually a word which many people at the time should not, did believe that a clergyman should not mention. Because basically, a coprolite is fossilized excrement.
It's no wonder.
And it comes from the Greek word kopros, which means excrement.
Oh, okay.
And lithos, of course, which is stone, stony excrement. Why it was so important is that Buckland realized these things in 1829 in the excavation of gigantic lizards called ichthyosauri. Meaning literally giant fish lizards in Greek.
Right.
These were the size of double-decker buses. And he found these things inside them. And they were about an inch in diameter from 2-3 inches long. Maybe like 2.5 centimeters by 10 centimeters, mm-hmm. something like that. And he realized that they were things which were going through the creature's gut when it died.
Oh.
And, of course, the soft tissue all rotted away. Only the harder stuff survived. And he came to realize that you could actually tell where these creatures' guts and internal organs were from the presence of the coprolites in their bodies. Now, this enabled you to get a window into the internal anatomy of creatures which had died millions and millions of years ago.
Wow.
They also had another big advantage. At this time, of course, organic chemistry was rapidly on the rise. And in fact, Justus von Liebig in Gießen in Germany, and also Buckland's friend Charles Daubeny, the great chemist here in Oxford, came to realize that these coprolites were rich in nitrates and phosphates. And these were excellent for reviving the soil, for turning poor soil into good soil. And of course, not only did you find the coprolites inside the guts of these great fish lizards, but also too, you found them in enormous thick beds in the countryside. So dig down in certain areas like Lincolnshire and so on, and you'd hit absolute strata of these fossilized coprolites, which had once been the beds of ancient oceans. They realized if you dug these out, ground them to powder using steam engines, you had a very, very nutritious fertilizer. And so instead of having to let the land go fallow for a year, you could just pitch old coprolites on it, powdered coprolites. They would rapidly turn into nutritious chemicals in the soil, and you'd get extra crops. And this meant, of course, they were playing a major part to feeding the population. So you may say the finding of coprolites, on the one hand, gives it a clue to the internal anatomy of these giant fish lizards, and on the other hand, helps modern people get more bread.
That's incredible. That's fascinating. You purposely put that word into the title of the book so that it an easy starter for people like me. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, William Buckland, we're talking here about the early 1800s, aren't we?
Yes, he was born in 1784, died in 1856.
Okay.
So he's really hits famously in about 1810.
Okay.
And so he's a massively big figure, 1810 to about 1850. Sadly, the last 6 years of his life were blighted with what we would now call dementia,
okay.
tragically.
Okay.
But from about 1805, 1810, down to 1850, 45 years, he was a massive presence, not really in Britain, but in Europe. He knew Germany. He went with Cuvier, the great French fossil geologist, dug in Italy, dug the volcanoes of the Auvergne. I mean, he really was a truly international geologist and a person fascinated by the origins of the Earth.
Now, he was a theologian and a scientist.
Pardon?
He was a theologian and a scientist?
He was more than just a theologian. He was a canon of Christ Church Cathedral.
Now, this is... This is where I got... I didn't get confused, but I think about a theologian, obviously, into theology and trying to, you know, find out more about God and religion and things like that. And then scientists, on the other hand, would be at loggerheads a lot of the time with the teachings of many churches. So how did he...
Sorry, just say that again, please.
The scientific world would normally or would often be at loggerheads with the churches because they would believe certain things in relation to creation and theologians would believe others. How did he marry the two?
Do you know, first of all, the idea of the church and science being at loggerheads is one of the great... myth of the 20th century.
It
is a myth of Mount Everest standing. When you look at the early scientific community, large numbers of men were in holy orders. Large numbers of men who were not in holy orders were devout Christians. And the idea that somehow science and religion fell out is a myth created by people like Thomas Henry Huxley, in our own time, Richard Dawkins, and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at the evidence at the time, and it's not there. Buckland actually says on one occasion that it is an insult to God not to use the brains that he has given us to work out where the earth has come from. So in other words, our intelligence, a gift of God, is a thing to actually unravel the world. And of course he realizes that yes, it's not quite what's in the Bible. But what his argument broadly is that the early books of the Bible, Genesis especially, is a what you might call a greatly compressed version of the origin of the world. And its purpose, of course, was not to teach science. It was to basically teach Moses and the very ancient Jews, effectively, that God had made the world. But then, we find by intelligence that the world is vastly older, yet it is not different. Because still God has made the world, its wonder, its beauty, and everything is there. All the sequences of nature that are in Genesis are there. But indeed, it's much bigger, much older, and much more complex. You might even say, without speaking in any way reverently, that reading Genesis is a bit like today, a book on relativity physics for 10-year-olds.
Really? Okay.
In other words, it's all there, all the facts, all the truth is there, but it's adapted for a much lower level of understanding.
Okay.
And that didn't mean, of course, that the ancient Jews were stupid, far, far from it, but they simply knew far, far less than we do. And, of course, as Buckland points out on one important occasion, in a way that you never have fossils and giant reptiles mentioned in the Bible, so likewise, God on Mount Sinai never told Moses about the nature of Newton's laws of dynamics or the modern laws of chemistry. But we know that they're all true. So in other words, what God has done is create us in his image. He has created us in a world that's richly beautiful and complex, and then given us the brains to work out the working details for ourselves. And it's an opinion I fully share. And it did not get screaming, it did not get yowling. The idea about fundamentalism, that's a 20th century phenomenon. And it was very, very easily accepted.
Okay.
Many people thought that way.
come back to the book if we can. What do we learn in the book? Caves, coprolites and catastrophes. Do you take us through William Buckland's travels and and what he has discovered and where and what it led to?
Oh, well, we start off because it was early. He came from Devon, which, of course, he came from an area which is rich in fossils. South of Devon, we now call the Jurassic Coast.
Right.
Because of all the things found down there. He then, of course, geologized, once he was in Oxford, came to Oxford in 1801. He geologized with friends literally everywhere. Scotland, all across his country, Wales, Ireland, France, Germany, Europe, Eastern Europe, Spain, all over. And as I point out too, in those days, geology was not for softies. There were no 4x4-wheel drive cars.
No.
There were no modern camping equipment. And if you wanted to go and do research in the Scottish Highlands, you only had your legs on a horse, and you had to assume you'd be soaking wet through most of the time.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there were no luxuries there. And he mentions on one occasion with he and another clergyman friend, William Daniel Conybeare, was another Devonshire friend, in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and they discovered a thing called paramudras, which were actually fossilized sponges, as we now understand. And after a day in the pouring rain in Northern Ireland, tramping around, soaking wet through and everything, they go to a little cottage. And they knock at the door, and the old lady invites them in. And she very, very kindly does some bacon and eggs and so obviously, they pay her a good few shillings for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, how would you find geologizing today? But after a long, cold, wet day in very, very wild country, you just turn up at some little cottage and you luckily get a bacon and egg supper.
Well,
and probably curl up by the floor to go by the fire to go to sleep.
Excuse me.
They were certainly not softies.
No, definitely not.
The idea, too, is that, you know, clergymen were prim and proper. Not the case. Buckland had a roaring sense of humour, as his friends did as well. And he was famous for his jokes and his escapes and his escapades and so on. And, of course, another very interesting with him, too, was his wife. She didn't travel at first with him because they weren't married until he was 40.
Right.
But Mary, in fact, herself was a very, very skilled anatomist, draftswoman, chemist, and fossil geologist. And the idea that, you know, there were no women in science in those days is simply, plainly, untrue. Mary was actually a very, very active geologist in her own right. When Buckland died in 1856, she went back to one of her old areas, which is, of course, a microscopic marine biology.
Wow.
She was a serious marine biologist. And so, you know, the book opens up all sorts of areas we often don't think on. Mm. The relationship between science and the Christian faith, the status of women in science, Buckland's fascination with taking geology and science and Christianity into the wider world in public lectures and all sorts of things. And then at the latter part of his life, a different related area, when he becomes Dean of Westminster Abbey, he's very much concerned with public health, improved sewer systems, street lighting, bringing in clean water. And although the discovery of germs still lay 20 years in the future,
right,
well, he is realizing that dirty water and illness go together without quite knowing why. The connection would be discovered by people like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch 25 years later.
Incredible
but
stuff.
He came to realize that dirt and disease went together. So he's a great, great public health man as well.
All right. Well, it appears as though reading this book, we meet a lot of great characters and we get to learn a lot about William Buckland himself and the legacies that he has left and the people that he has inspired. It's called Caves, Copper Lights and Catastrophes. It's written by Dr. Alan Chapman. It is available on the TRE website at tre.radio. And Dr. Alan Chapman, I want to say thank you for joining me today on the program.
It's been a great pleasure, and a great joy to you all, and stay germ-free and fit and perky. And I hope that people will enjoy Caves and Copper Lights.
I'm sure they will. I've certainly enjoyed talking to you, Bob. Bye-bye. Thank you very much indeed.